Would you please welcome the Right Honorable Beverly McLaughlin.
Thank you, Bob, for that very gracious introduction. I noted you took 6 years off my age, and I'm immensely grateful for that, too. It doesn't happen often enough. But it's wonderful to be here today, and I must say I feel deeply inspired to see such a large audience, so many people who have come out because they care about justice, and they care about better justice, more compassionate justice. So it is a great privilege to be with you and share some of my thoughts. I'm very much looking forward to hearing your thoughts and questions after my preliminary remarks, but let me begin with a few thoughts of my own. Sometimes when I look back, I think my life is composed of things I never intended to do. I never intended to write a memoir. I recall in my early days in the Supreme Court of Canada, there was a story going around that a certain justice had been asked to write his autobiography. He said, "Let me think about it over the weekend." And he came back on Monday and he said, "The answer is no." And the would-be publisher said, "Well, why?" And he said, "Living it once was enough." And I had always thought there was a certain wisdom in that response. And indeed, parts of writing my memoir were difficult. Living things twice were difficult. But many of them were very satisfying. And one of the most satisfying things was that I was privileged in doing so to look over the arc of Canadian justice in Canada during the time that I had been a lawyer and had been on the bench. And in that almost 50 years, the changes in our justice system, and particularly the changes in the values that people who care about justice in Canada espouse. I was privileged that my whole judicial career was paralleled by the arc of the Charter, which was brought in 1982, as you know, and I became a judge in 81. And everybody at the time was very concerned in one way or another about the Charter. There were those who said that radical judges would use it to destroy our country and the justice system. And there were those who feared that the judges wouldn't be radical enough. But in the end, I do believe that the Charter has been a force for the good, and I'll say a little bit more about that later. The second thing I never intended to do was be a lawyer. As Bob has told you, I received no encouragement at school, let's put it that way, to do anything other than what were acknowledged as the proper roles for a woman. First of all, getting married and having children, but on the side, or before, if you wished, maybe being a nurse, for which I would have been abysmally suited with my low alertness score. People would have died in droves. A teacher, which I might have managed, but alertness counts there too, I understand. I was told in grade 8 that that not only, you know, the reading retention wouldn't do me much good, but also the teacher trying to be helpful said, there are two things you must never be, a waitress or a telephone operator. So that steered me in the direction of the law, right? Well, in fact, I was able, with the help of government scholarships and that kind of thing, to get an undergraduate degree in philosophy, and I was intent on doing graduate work and becoming a university philosophy teacher. But I did get derailed. First of all, I was starting to wonder about whether a career in philosophy, which at that time was very linguistically dominant, and I was more interested in moral philosophy, was the right fit. And secondly, I had a friend who later became my first husband, who asked me whether I'd ever thought about the law. And I gave him a frank answer, and I said, no, I've never thought about law. And he said, well, I think you should. I think you'd be a good lawyer. So I thought about that, and I thought, do I know any women who have ever succeeded in law? And I could not come up with one name, not one example. Now, I later learned that there had been one or two very distinguished women who had distinguished careers in the law in Ontario, and the odd one here or there, but I knew of no one at that time, and all I knew was that the law seemed to be very much a man's world. This was in the mid-60s, so just before first wave feminism came on the scene. Anyway, I went back to the ranch after completing some work I was doing as the philosophy department as a TA in August, and I decided to at least ask for information. So I had no idea who the dean of law was in Alberta, but I wrote a letter addressed to Dean of Law, University of Alberta. And in the letter, I said, could you please send me some information about studying law? Well, 4 days later, I went to our little Pincher Creek post office to get the mail, which was one of my duties, and I shuffled through the odds and ends and bills, and there was a very slim white envelope addressed to me. I thought, well, that's bad news, because it's clearly not information. I'm clearly much too late, or there's some other impediment. And I opened the letter, and it was penned by the Dean of Law, whom I discovered was named Wilbur Bowker. And he said, thank you for your inquiry. I'm pleased to inform you that you are admitted to the study of law. Please show up on September the 4th. So without that preemptive act, I would never have become a lawyer. I decided that, well, it wasn't quite time. September 4th, I didn't have to be at my graduate school's until a couple of weeks later. So I said, I'll give the law a week. And of course, I've been in it ever since. But Wilbur Bowker was a feminist. He had been in a day when there were no feminists, in a day when we didn't know the name. But his wife had studied law and never been able to practice. And he believed that was wrong. And he was going to do everything he could do to change the world and get more women in law. So if you believe in something, take the trouble to make it work. Do that. Take that preemptive step, even if it's unusual. Don't let the bureaucratic niceties hold you back. Anyway, I went to law school and had a wonderful time. I loved the law for its combination of theoretical and principled moral philosophy in action, if you wish, and its hands-on impact on people's lives. In the law, you deal with real people's problems. And that was what seemed to me so exciting about the law. And that is what has sustained me, I think, through all the subsequent decades. I remember the first days practicing when I interviewed for articles. The gentleman interviewing me after what I thought was a splendid interview, I was sure I had my articles, he said, "Why do you want to practice law?" I didn't realize till later that it was the view at the time in 1968 that if a woman was married, and I had married the previous summer, she would not work outside the house. And so those were the kind of attitudes that shaped my early time. Fortunately, I found a wonderful firm that accepted women, accepted me, and were very kind and supportive. But even so, the atmosphere was very, very different in those days, as I describe in my book. But one of the things that my firm taught me was that you never turned anyone away. And I, as a very young lawyer, inherited some of the walk-in cases. And, a woman who had been deprived of all her family property under false pretenses by a would-be suitor, an indigenous boy who had committed suicide in a cell and the family wanted some sort of redress. These cases were cases that where people had no money, but they wanted to find justice. And our little firm seemed to have a reputation as never closing the door to anyone. Sometimes they'd send you down the street, but basically they welcomed you and tried to find a solution to your problem. And when I look back on those early years, sure, I did lots of big insurance cases, I did a few criminal cases, but those cases where the people walked in off the street and where I was able to get justice for them against all the odds resonate in my memory as being extremely important. I taught for a while and then I went to academe for a time, which I enjoyed, and then unexpectedly I found myself asked to go on the bench. And those were days when the government of the day, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, John Turner, those people had decided that it was no longer acceptable that Canada would have a bench comprised exclusively of middle-aged and aging white Anglo-Saxon men, that we needed more diversity, and in particularly we needed some women, because after all, half the people were women, and they should see themselves reflected in the court, and women's perspectives should be brought to bear on justice. So I had what was has been described as a meteoric rise through the courts, as I was pushed higher and higher where they needed a woman, I guess. And in fact, when I was sworn in at the Supreme Court of Canada, the treasurer of the Law Society of British Columbia told the audience that I had made it through the court system faster than most cases. which brings us to our justice system and access to justice in a rather peculiar way. Justice was slow then, and it's still slow. Access to justice was a problem then, but no one really talked about it much. And that is what I'd like to spend a few moments now just reflecting on. We have a wonderful justice system in Canada by many, many standards, and indeed indexes like the World Justice Project rank us quite high. We have a rule of law in its full sense. carried out and administered through our justice institutions, from the police downward. We have very good appellate systems to make sure the whole system works properly. We have a wonderful Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which has given us foundational values and put them in constitutional form so that they inhere and express themselves through our whole body of law and our system of justice. And all of this is wonderful. One of the minor miracles, if you know anything about justice in other parts, many other parts of the world, is that we don't have corruption. We really don't. And this is something very difficult for people in many parts of the world to understand. They live in a world where you have to know the judge, or pay the judge, or pay the policeman, or do something else to get access to justice. And that is a very, very bad thing. So we have this wonderful justice system. We also have an independent judiciary and an independent prosecutorial services, which prevents the executive from meddling in day-to-day justice matters, and which guarantees every Canadian the right to the decision that a judge, informed by the law and the facts, believes is the just one in that case. So we have this great system of justice, but we do have some problems. And the main problem that I see is access to justice. Now, access to justice is a very broad term. And it just refers to the fact that you can't get the justice that you should for whatever reason. Often it's a question of not having enough resources. We know that putting a case through court, even getting a good defense in a criminal case, can be extremely expensive. Often it's a question of time. People say, it takes too long. Our criminal cases take too long. Our civil cases take so long that sometimes by the time you get your decision, your whole business or personal life has moved on and it hardly seems to matter. We need to, and sometimes it's a question of who you are and where you're coming from. If you're mentally ill, you're probably going to have a lot more trouble getting access to justice, and you may get something else, like a bullet in the head, if you act out on a bus. If you come from certain communities, Indigenous communities, where the justice system is often, perhaps with some justification, viewed as alien and remote and imposed on high, from on high, you too will have a tougher shake. And although we battle it mightily, and I think we are amongst the most progressive nations in the world in this, things like racism and stereotypes, be they against women sometimes, Indigenous people, people of color, sometimes, occasionally, I like to think in these days, because we don't countenance it, but occasionally can play a role in whether a person gets full justice or not. Well, in the mid 2000s, I'd been a Chief Justice of Canada for about 4 years. I began to reflect on the problems we have with access to justice, and I came to Toronto and gave a speech here on access to justice. It was picked up in the press. And I was astounded by the response. I suddenly found myself getting all sorts, my office, we were barraged with letters and emails and tweets and all those sorts of things. And sad stories from many people, and I still get some of these stories, even though I'm no longer on the bench, who were telling me how they didn't get access to justice, how they couldn't afford to hire a lawyer when a renovation that took their life savings went bad, or how they found themselves enmeshed in the criminal system and didn't get proper representation, and on and on and on. And I realized that this was a much bigger issue than even I had thought, and that our justice system, while it's a lovely, shiny, pretty justice system on the surface, wasn't actually serving the needs of many Canadian women, men, and, dare I say, children, because among the victims of lack of access to justice are often those little ones who need protection, or whose parents require some legal intervention to settle their future. And months could go by before I learned you got a court date on some of these protective custody issues. That didn't seem to me to be right. All sorts of bad things could happen in those months. Well, we people took up the cause. Tom Cromwell, whom some of you will know, justice on the Supreme Court. Before he was a justice on the Supreme Court, he was on the Nova Scotia Court of Appeal. And he came to me and he said, we need to start an action committee on family and civil justice. And I agreed. He did all the work. I was a titular president, but he was amazing in getting together people across the country to talk about improving civil and family justice. And I think, although the work is slow, we have seen many, many improvements in this area, many innovations, and we've discovered that access to justice isn't always just about getting into court. It's about getting people the right legal information. It's about getting people help and connecting with whoever they need to connect with to solve their problem. It's about many things other than simply standing up before a judge, although that is important. Let me then move to, before I leave the civil side, I will say that the resolution of civil disputes is still not where it needs to be. We are still facing too many delays and other problems. But governments are making efforts. We've seen the jurisdictional limits of direct informal courts increase vastly, so ordinary people can get their disputes sorted out with a minimal of legal rigmarole. This is a big topic and one I will leave for another day, although I will say I think we need to embrace whatever technologies we can to improve our civil justice system without, and I emphasize this, instituting a regime of justice by machine. I think we have to maintain the human component and the humanity of our justice system, the compassion of our justice system on the civil side as well as on the criminal. One of the things that's happening now, and which we will see a lot more of in the decades to come, is artificial intelligence in the justice system. And you all understand, I'm sure, about the phenomenon of deep learning, machines that draw on huge data networks and teach themselves and can predict what should happen in particular cases, can take facts, spit out a result, etc. And we are now seeing these aids being introduced into justice systems. In England, Susskind, a scholar on access to justice in England, has just published a book called Online Courts. And in it, he describes a justice system for civil cases which uses AI and technological advances, A, at the first level, to inform people about the law or about their recourses, etc. At the second level, actually, with the help of trained court officials, sort out a way to get that justice. And then at the third level, those cases that can't be settled or whatever, disposed of without going to court, envisions having trials before a real judge. Aided, however, in some cases by technology and AI. We now have in the United States a number of cases where judges have been assisted in sentencing and parole by algorithms that look at a variety of factors that touch on touch on the issue, be it parole, sentencing, and come up with an answer of whether the person should be granted parole or what the sentence should be. And this frightens many people. In the cases in the United States, they've always had a judge, and the judge makes the decision. But it's interesting, the statistic I read was that in 95% of the cases, the judge accepted the algorithm. Of course, the algorithmic result. Of course, this is only as good as what you put into it for data. So you have to be worried about racism and things like that that might creep in, and other factors. That system is being challenged in some appellate levels. And I'll go quickly, but in China, we have 100,000 judges. They had virtually a very small justice system, very big needs, and they have set up a whole justice system, civil and criminal, which is more and more based on these algorithms and predictors and so on. So I just mention that to say this is probably something we need to think about for the future. And in some applications, it could be very good. It could help people get more information. It could help them resolve their problems extrajudicially and provide better justice in many, many cases. But we do have to be aware of some of the problems. Well, going to the criminal system, criminal justice system, we again, I think, have a good criminal justice system. But we have to constantly be vigilant to make sure it functions the way it should. Delays have been a great problem, and those of you in the law will probably know about the Supreme Court of Canada decision in Jordan, which sent the message that the charter guarantee that you have a right to a trial within a reasonable time means what it says, and that criminal trials can't drag on for years. And I believe the response in the courts across the country has been quite positive, and we've seen great attempts made to shorten criminal proceedings to reasonable delays and to assure that people really can get a trial within a reasonable time. You have to remember, a lot of those people are going to be waiting in prison before any conviction. So this is a very, very serious matter. And we need to, I think, keep improving the efficiency of our criminal courts, of our criminal procedures, and keep working on this problem of delay. Legal assistance is another problem. People cannot get, generally speaking, justice in our criminal system unless they have a lawyer to help them. The law is complicated, and they need to know what defenses they can raise, and they need to know how to raise them. They need to know the procedures you have to follow. They need to know what their rights are. How can an ordinary person on the street, perhaps someone of not much education, give himself or herself a defense? And yet that is their right under the charter. So this is why so many people have been so concerned about the legal aid system, which has always, this is a great generalization, but more often than not been underfunded than properly funded. And of course, I have spoken out, registering my distress about the cuts that we experienced recently in this province to legal aid funding. It seems to me that cutting funding in a way that means that people in the throes of the criminal system don't have legal assistance is perversely, not only unjust, but perversely inefficient. If trials go longer, wrongful convictions are increased, people plead guilty when they have a defense. People get incarcerated, and that's hugely expensive when they shouldn't be incarcerated. And then we find out after the fact that the conviction was wrongful, and there is injustice done that can never be properly remedied. I think we need to say people who are facing criminal charges, even charges that may not be major ones like murder and robbery and whatever, are entitled to legal assistance. The system cannot work unless people have legal assistance. And it works best when they have adequate legal assistance, and in the long run, that will save everybody money. But of course, the major consideration should always be provision of justice. It will keep us safer from injustice. So I do hope that governments in Canada will see their way to doing better. British Columbia has instituted some reforms that are very promising. Are they adequate? I don't comment, but there is at least a recognition there that we have to provide assistance to people in the criminal system. Another problem in the criminal system is the over-representation in courts and carceral facilities of Indigenous people. This is very complex. It's not easy. But we need to set our minds against it. We need to figure out why it's happening, and we need to make sure that we are on the road to curing the situation. And the final one I'll mention is mental health, because although many people have said it, it seems somehow to go too often unheeded that many, many people who find themselves in the criminal justice system are mentally unwell. I was sitting in Rideau Hall a number of years ago, and a local police chief from downtown Toronto was next to me, and I had just made some charter decision that had been condemned as judicial activism and on the criminal front, and I thought, well, this is going to be an interesting conversation. Anyway, I asked him, what are your thoughts on the criminal justice system? He said, what are your biggest problem? I said, as an administrator in the criminal, as in the police system. He said, mental health, without missing a beat. He said, you know, where people are committing petty crimes just to get picked up, to get a bed in jail, it's a revolving door, and we and my officers are so frustrated because we aren't able to meet their health. We can't give them the help they need. So this is a huge problem, and it needs much more attention, in my opinion. I rather think I've gone on too long, but I thank you for your patience. And at this point, I think I would like to turn it over to you for your observations and questions. I hope we can have a good dialogue.